at once of the patrols that the milksop was only too likely to send to isolated farms at night. Heart thudding, she reached for the knife that lay under her pillow and threw on her dress, while the Martin pawed more and more impatiently at the door. Luckily, he hadn't yet woken Jehan. Her son was fast asleep. Her goose wasn't giving the alarm either, which was strange. Barefoot, she went to the door, knife in hand, and listened. But there was nothing to be heard outside. And when she cautiously went out into the open air, she felt as if she heard the night itself breathing deeply and regularly, like someone asleep. The stars shone down on her like flowers made of light, and their beauty hurt her weary heart. Roxanne. The Martin shot past her. It couldn't be true. The dead did not come back, even when they had promised they would. But the figure emerging from the shadows near the stable was so very familiar. Gwyn hissed when he saw the other Martin sitting on his master's shoulder. Roxanne. He spoke her name as if he wanted to savor it on his tongue, like something he hadn't tasted for a long time. It was a dream, one of the dreams she had almost every night, dreams in which she saw his face so clearly that she touched it in her sleep, and next day her fingers still remembered his skin. Even when he put his arms around her, carefully, as if he wasn't sure whether he had forgotten how to hold her, she didn't move, because her hands did not believe they would really feel him. Her arms did not believe they could hold him again. But her eyes could see him. Her ears heard him breathing. Her skin felt his, as warm as if the fire were inside him, after he had been so terribly cold. He had kept his promise. And even if he was coming to her only in a dream, it was better than nothing. So much better. Roxanne, look at me. Look at me. He took her face between his hands, caressed her cheek, wiped away the tears she so often felt on her skin when she woke. And only then did she draw him close to her, let her hands tell her that she wasn't just embracing a ghost. It couldn't be true. She wept as she pressed her face to his. She wanted to hit him for having left her for the boy's sake, for all the pain she had already felt on his account, so much pain. But her heart gave her away, as it had the first time he came back. It always gave her away. What is it? He kissed her once more. The scars, they were gone, as if the white women had washed them away before sending him back to life. She took his hands and laid them against his cheeks. Well, who'd have thought it? He said, stroking his own skin with his fingers as if it were a stranger's. They've really gone. Basta wouldn't like that at all. Why had they let him go? Who had paid the price for him, as he had paid it for the boy? Why did she ask? He was back. That was all that mattered. Back from the place from which there was no return, where all the others were. Her daughter, the father of her son, Cosimo, so many dead. But he had come back. Even if she saw in his eyes that this time he had been so far away that something of him was still left there. How long will you stay this time? She whispered. He did not answer at once. Gwyn rubbed his head against his neck and looked at him as if he too wanted to know the answer. As long as death allows, he replied at last, and placed her hand on his beating heart. What does that mean? She whispered. But he closed her mouth with a kiss. Chapter 28. A New Song.
The Blue Jays come back from the dead!
It was Doria who brought the Black Prince the news. The boy stumbled into his tent just before dawn, so breathless that he could hardly get the words out.
A moss woman saw him, by the hollow trees where the healers bury their dead. She says he's brought the Fire Dancer back too. Please, may I tell Maggie?
Incredible words, far too wonderful to be true. All the same, the Black Prince set off at once for the place where the hollow trees grew. After making Doria promise not to tell anyone else what he had told him, neither Meggie nor her mother, neither Snapper nor any of the other robbers, not even his own brother, who was lying outside by the fire, fast asleep.
But they say the Pipers heard about it too,
the boy faltered. That's unfortunate, replied the prince. Let's hope I find him before the Piper does. He rode fast, so fast that the bear was soon snorting with disapproval as he trotted along beside him. Why such haste? For a foolish hope? Why did his heart always insist on believing that there was a light in all the darkness? Where did he keep getting new hope from, after he had been disappointed countless times? You have the heart of a child, Prince. Hadn't Dustfinger always told him so? And he's brought the Fire Dancer back, too. It couldn't be true. Such things happened only in songs, and in the stories that mothers told their children in the evening to drive away nighttime fears. Hope can make you careless. He should have known that, too. The Black Prince didn't see the soldiers until they emerged ahead of him through the trees. A good number of them. He counted 10. They had a moss woman with them, her thin neck already rubbed sore by the rope on which they were pulling her along. Presumably they had caught her to make her lead them to the hollow trees, for hardly anyone knew the place where the healers buried their dead. They themselves, so rumor said, made sure that all the paths to it were hidden by undergrowth. But after helping Roxanne to take Dustfinger there, the Black Prince knew the way. It was a sacred place, but in her fear, the moss woman had indeed led the men-at-arms the right way. The crowns of the dead trees could already be seen in the distance. They rose, as grey as if morning had stripped them bare among the oaks, which were still autumnal gold, and the prince prayed the blue jay wasn't there. Better to be with the white women than in the piper's hands. 3 men-at-arms came upon him from behind, swords in their hands. The moss woman sank to her knees as her captors drew their own swords and turned to their new quarry. The bear reared up on his hind legs and bared his teeth. The horses shied, and 2 of the soldiers retreated. But there were still a great many of them. Too many for a knife and a pair of claws.
Well, guess what? Obviously the Piper's not the only one stupid enough to believe moss women's gossip.
Their leader was almost as pale as the white women, and his face was sprinkled with freckles.
The Black Prince, none other. There was I, cursing my luck, sent riding into this damn forest to catch a ghost. And who should stumble into my path but his black brother? The price on your head isn't as high as the price for the blue jay, but it'll make us all rich men.
You're wrong there. Touch him, and you'll be dead men instead.
And his voice wakens the dead from sleep and makes the wolf lie down with the lamb. The blue jay stepped out from behind a beech tree as naturally as if he had been waiting for the soldiers there.
Don't call me blue jay. It's only a name from the songs.
He had said that to the prince so often. But what else was he to call him?
Blue Jay.
They were whispering his name, their voices hoarse with terror. Who was he? The prince had often wondered. Did he really come from the land where Dustfinger had spent so many years? And what kind of country was it? A land where songs came true?
Blue Jay.
The bear roared him a welcome that made the horses rear. And the jay drew his sword very slowly, as he always did, the sword that had once belonged to Firefox and had killed so many of the Black Prince's men. The face beneath the dark hair seemed paler than usual, but the prince could see no fear in it. Presumably you forgot what fear was once you visited death.
Yes, as you see, I'm really back from the dead, even if I still feel death's claws in me.
He spoke dreamily, as if a part of him were still with the white women.
I'm willing to show you the way, if you want. It's entirely up to you, but if you do prefer to live a little longer, he added, flourishing his sword in the air as if he were writing their names, then let him go. Him and the bear.
They just stared at him, and their hands, resting on their swords, trembled as if they were reaching out for their own deaths. Nothing is more terrifying than fearlessness. And the Black Prince went to the Blue Jay's side and felt that the words were like a shield for them, the words sung quietly up and down the country, all about the White Hand and the Black Hand of Justice. "There'll be a new song now," thought the prince as he drew his sword, and his heart felt so foolishly young that he could have fought 1,000 men. As for the piper's soldiers, they wrenched their horses' heads around and fled from just 2 men and the words. When they had gone, the blue jay went over to the moss woman, who was still kneeling in the grass with her hands pressed to her bark-brown face, and undid the rope from her neck.
"A few months ago, one of you tended a bad wound I had," he said. "It wasn't you, was it?"
The moss woman let him help her up, but she looked at him suspiciously.
"What do you mean by that? That we all look the same to human eyes?" she snapped. "Well, we feel the same about you. So how am I supposed to know if I ever set eyes on you before?"
And she limped away without another look at her rescuer, who stood there watching her go, as if he had forgotten where he was.
"How long have I been away?" he asked when the Black Prince joined him.
"Over 3 days."
"As long as that?"
Yes, he had been far away, very far away.
"Of course, time runs differently when you meet death. Isn't that what they say?"
"You know more about it than I do now," replied the prince. The blue jay made no comment on that.
"Have you heard who I brought with me?" he asked at last.
"It's difficult for me to believe such good news," said the Black Prince huskily. But the blue jay smiled and ran a hand over the prince's short hair.
"You can let it grow again," he said. "The man you shaved it for is breathing again. He's left his scars with the dead, that's all." It couldn't be true. "Where is he?"
His heart still ached from the night when he had kept watch with Roxanne at Dustfinger's side.
"No doubt with Roxanne. I didn't ask him where he was going. We were neither of us particularly talkative. The white women leave silence behind them, Prince, not words."
"Silence?" the Black Prince laughed and embraced him. "What are you talking about? They've left joy behind, pure joy, and hope, hope again at last. I feel younger than I've felt for years, as if I could tear up trees by the roots. Well, maybe not that beech, but many others. By this evening, everyone will be singing that the blue jay fears death so little that he seeks it out, and the piper will tear the silver nose off his face in a rage." The blue jay smiled again. But his look was still grave, very grave for a man who has just come back from the dead unscathed. And the Black Prince realized that there was bad news behind the good news, a shadow behind all the light. But they didn't speak of that. Not yet.
"What about my wife and my daughter?" asked the Blue Jay. Have they already gone?"
"Gone?" The Black Prince looked at him in surprise.
"No. Where would they go?"
Relief and worry were mingled equally in the other man's face.
"Sometime I'll explain all that to you, too," he said. "Sometime. But it's a long story."
Chapter 29 A Visitor to Orpheus's Cellar. When Os, gripping Farid firmly by the back of his neck, told him that Orpheus wanted to see him in his study at once, he took 2 bottles of wine with him. Cheeseface had been drinking like a fish ever since their return from the graveyard of the strolling players, but the wine didn't make Orpheus talkative, like Fenolio, just extremely malicious and unpredictable. As so often, he was by the window when Farid entered the study. He was swaying slightly and staring at the sheet of paper that he'd studied over and over again these last few days, cursing, crumpling it up, and then smoothing it out again.
"There it is, in black and white. Every letter perfect as a picture. And it sounds good, too. It sounds damn good," he said thickly, as his finger kept tapping the words. "So why, by all the infernal spirits, did the bookbinder come back again, too?"
What was Cheeseface talking about? Farid put the wine bottles on the table and stood there waiting.
"Os says you want to speak to me?"
he asked. Jasper was sitting beside the jug of pens, making frantic signals, but Farid couldn't work out what they meant.
"Ah, yes, Dustfinger's Angel of Death,"
Orpheus put the paper down on his desk and turned to him with a nasty smile.
Why on earth did you come back to him? Farid asked himself,
but he had only to think of the hatred on Meggy's face in the graveyard to answer his own question.
Because you didn't know where else to go.
Yes, I sent for you.
Orpheus looked at the door. Oss had followed Farid into the room, more silently than you would have thought possible for a man of his size. And before Farid had time to realize why Jasper was waving to him so frantically, Oss's meaty hands had seized him.
So you haven't heard the news yet? Said Orpheus. Of course not. If you had, I'm sure you'd have gone chasing straight off to him.
Off to whom?
Farid tried to wriggle free, but Oss pulled his hair so hard that tears of pain came to his eyes.
He really doesn't know. How touching.
Orpheus came so close to him that the smell of the wine on his breath made Farid feel sick.
Dust finger, said Orpheus in his velvety voice. Dust finger is back.
Farid immediately forgot all about Oss's rough fingers and Orpheus's unpleasant smile. There was nothing in him but joy, like a violent pain, too much for his heart to bear.
Yes, he's back, Orpheus went on, thanks to my words. But the rabble out there are saying the blue jay brought him back, he added with a dismissive gesture to the window. Curse them! May the piper make maggot flesh of them all!
Farid wasn't listening. His own blood was roaring in his ears.
Dustfinger was back! Back!
Let go of me, Chunk!
Farid drove his elbows into Oss's stomach and tugged at his hands.
Dustfinger will turn his fire on you, he shouted. That's what he'll do the moment he hears you two didn't let me go to him at once!
Really?
Orpheus blew wine-laden breath into his face again.
I'm more inclined to think he'll be grateful to me. Or do you suppose he'd like you to bring him to his death again, you ill-omened brat? I warned him about you once before. He wouldn't listen to me then, but he'll have learned better now, believe you me. If I had the book you came from here, I'd have read you back into your own story long ago, but sad to say, it's out of print in this world.
Orpheus laughed. He liked to laugh at his own jokes.
Lock him in the cellar, he told the chunk. And as soon as it's dark, you can take him out to the hill where the gallows stand and wring his neck. No one will notice a few bones more or less up there.
Jasper put his hands over his eyes when Oss picked up Farid and threw him over his shoulder. Farid shouted and kicked. But the chunk hit him in the face so hard that he almost lost consciousness.
The blue jay! The blue jay! I sent him to the white women! I did it!
He heard Orpheus's voice ringing down the stairs after them.
So why, by the devil's tail, didn't death keep him? Didn't I make that high-minded idiot sound tempting enough with the finest words I could write?
At the bottom of the stairs, Farid made another attempt to free himself. But Oss hit him in the face again so hard that blood ran from his nose and then shifted him to his other shoulder. A maid, alarmed, stuck her face out of the kitchen doorway as he carried Farid past. It was the little brown-haired girl who was always making eyes at him. But she didn't help him. How could she?
Get out,
was all Oss growled at her before dragging Farid down to the cellar. He tied him to one of the pillars supporting Orpheus's house, stuffed a dirty rag into his mouth, and left him alone, but not without giving him another vigorous kick first.
See you later when it's dark, he grunted, before trudging back upstairs,
and Farid was left behind with the cold stone at his back and the taste of his own tears in his mouth. It hurt so much to know that Dustfinger was back, and all the same he would never see him again. But that's how it will be, Farid, he told himself.
And who knows? Maybe Cheeseface is right. Perhaps you'd only bring him to his death again.
His tears burned his face, so sore from Oss's blows. If only he could have called up fire to consume Orpheus, complete with his house and the chunk, even if it meant that he too would burn. But he couldn't move his hands, and his tongue could not conjure up a word of fire. So he just crouched there, sobbing, as he had sobbed on the night of Dustfinger's death, waiting for evening to come, and Os to fetch him and wring his neck, under the same gallows where he had dug up silver for Orpheus. Luckily, the marten had gone. Os would certainly have killed him too. But presumably Jink had found his way to Dustfinger long ago. The marten would have sensed that he was back. "Why didn't you sense it yourself, Farid?" he wondered. Never mind, at least Jink was safe. But what would become of Jasper if he couldn't protect him anymore? Orpheus had often shut the glass man up in a drawer without any light or sand, just for cutting paper clumsily or splashing ink on his master's sleeve. Dustfinger. It did him good at least to try whispering the name and know he was alive. How often Farid had imagined what it would be like to see him again. Longing made him tremble as if he were shaken by a fever. Which of the martens had jumped on Dustfinger's shoulder first to lick his scarred face, he wondered? Gwyn or Jink? The hours went by, and after a while, Farid managed to spit out the gag. He tried gnawing through the rope that Os had used to tie him up, but even a mouse could have done better. Would they look for him when he was lying dead and buried on Gallows Hill? Dustfinger? Silvertongue? Meggie? Oh, Meggie! He would never kiss her again. Not that he'd done that so very often recently. All the same, that bastard Cheeseface. Farid called down every curse he could remember on him. Curses from this world, his own world, and the one where he had met Dustfinger. He shouted them all out loud, because that was the only way they worked, and fell silent in alarm when he heard the cellar door above him opening. Was it evening already? Probably. How could anyone tell in this damp, moldy hole? Would Os break his neck like a rabbit's, or simply press his fat hands down over his mouth until he couldn't breathe any more? Don't think about it, Farid. You'll find out soon enough. He pressed his back against the pillar. Perhaps he could at least kick Os's nose in. A well-aimed kick at that stupid face when he was taking off Farid's bonds, and it would break like a dry twig. He desperately braced himself against the rough rope, but unfortunately Os was good at tying people up. Meggie, can't you send a few words to save me as you did for your father? Fear was making his arms and legs weak. He listened to the footsteps coming down the stairs. They were surprisingly quiet for the chunk. And suddenly, two martens scurried toward him. By all the fairies, that moon-faced fellow really has been making money, a voice whispered in the darkness. What a grand house! A flame began dancing, then a second, a third, a fourth, a fifth, five flames, just bright enough to light up Dustfinger's face, and Jasper sitting on his shoulder with a shy smile. Dustfinger. Farid's heart felt so light that he wouldn't have been surprised if it had simply floated out of him. But what had happened to Dustfinger's face? It looked different, as if all the years had been washed away. All the sad, lonely years, and your scars, they're gone. Farid could only whisper. Happiness muted his words like cotton wool. Jink jumped up to him and licked his bound hands. Yes, and would you believe it, I think Roxanne misses them. Dustfinger reached the bottom step of the stairs and kneeled down beside him. From above, agitated voices came down to them. Drawing a knife from his belt, Dustfinger cut through Farid's bonds. Hear that? I'm afraid Orpheus is about to find out he has a visitor. Farid rubbed his numb wrists. He couldn't take his eyes off Dustfinger. Suppose he was only a ghost after all, or even worse, nothing but a dream. But then would Farid have felt his warmth and the beating of his heart when he leaned over him? No more of the dreadful silence that had surrounded Dustfinger in the mine. And he smelled of fire. The blue jay had brought him back. Yes, it must have been him. Whatever Orpheus said, oh, he'd write his name in fire on the city walls of Ombra. Silvertongue, blue jay, whichever name he liked. Farid put out his hand and timidly touched Dustfinger's face. So familiar, and yet so strange. Dustfinger laughed quietly and raised him to his feet. What is it? Do you want to make sure I'm not a ghost? I expect you're still afraid of them, aren't you? Suppose I was a ghost. By way of answer, Fareed flung his arms around him so impetuously that Jasper, with a sharp little scream, slid off Dustfinger's shoulder. Luckily, he caught the glass man before Gwyn did.
"Careful, careful,"
whispered Dustfinger, putting Jasper onto Fareed's shoulder. "You're still as clumsy as a young calf. You have your glass friend to thank for my being here. He told Brianna what Orpheus was planning to do to you, and she rode to Roxanne."
"Brianna?"
The glass man blushed when Fareed put him on his arm.
"Thank you, Jasper."
Then he spun around. Orpheus's voice came ringing down the cellar stairs.
"A stranger? What are you talking about? How did he get past you?" "It's the maid's fault,"
Fareed heard Os protesting.
"The red-haired maid let him in through the back door."
Dustfinger listened to the sounds above, smiling the old mocking smile that Fareed had missed so much. Sparks were dancing on his shoulders and his hair. They seemed to be shining even under his skin, and Fareed's own skin was hot, as if the fire had been licking it since he touched Dustfinger.
"The fire," he whispered. "Is it in you?"
"Maybe," Dustfinger whispered back. "I'm probably not entirely what I was, but I can do a few interesting new things."
"New things?"
Fareed looked at him, eyes wide, but the voice of Orpheus came down again from above.
"Smells of fire, does he? Let me pass, you human rhinoceros. Is his face scarred?"
"No. Why?"
Os sounded offended. And footsteps came down the stairs again, heavy and uncertain footsteps this time. Orpheus hated climbing either up or down stairs, and Fareed heard him cursing.
"Meggy read Orpheus here," he whispered as he pressed close to Dustfinger's side. "I asked her to do it because I thought he could bring you back."
"Orpheus?" Dustfinger laughed again. "No, it was only Silvertongue's voice I heard."
"His voice, perhaps, but it was my words that brought you back."
Orpheus stumbled down the last few steps, his face red from the wine.
"Dustfinger, it really is you."
There was genuine delight in his voice. Os appeared behind Orpheus, fear and rage on his coarse face.
"Look at him, my lord,"
he managed to get out.
"He's not human. He's a demon or a spirit of the night. See those sparks on his hair? When I tried to hold on to him, I almost burned my fingers, as if the executioner had put red-hot coals in my hands."
"Yes, yes," was all Orpheus said. "He comes from far away, very far away. Such a journey can change a man."
He was staring at Dustfinger, as if afraid he might dissolve into thin air at any moment, or more likely, into a few lifeless words on a sheet of paper.
"I'm so glad you're back,"
he stammered, his voice awkward with longing.
"And your scars have gone. How amazing. I didn't write that. Well, anyway, you're back. This world is worth only half as much without you, but now it will all be as wonderful as it was when I first read about you in Inkheart. It was always the best of all stories. But now, you'll be its hero. You alone, thanks to my art that took you home, and now has even brought you back from the realm of death."
"Your art? More likely Silvertongue's courage."
Dustfinger made a flame dance on his hand. It took on the shape of a white woman so distinctly that Os cowered against the cellar wall in terror.
"Nonsense!"
For a moment, Orpheus sounded like a boy with hurt feelings, but he soon had himself in hand again.
"Nonsense," he repeated,
with more self-control this time, although his tongue was still rather thick from the wine.
"Whatever he told you, it isn't true. I did it all."
"He didn't tell me anything. He didn't have to. He was there, he and his voice."
"But I had the idea, and I wrote the words. He was only my tool."
Orpheus spluttered the last word as furiously as if he were spitting it into Silvertongue's face.
"Ah, yes, your words, very cunning words, according to all I've heard from him."
The image of the white woman was still burning on Dustfinger's hand.
"Maybe I ought to take those words to Silvertongue, so that he can read them once more and find out what kind of part you intended him to play in all this."
Orpheus stood up very straight.
I wrote them like that for you, only for you, he cried in an injured voice. That was all I cared about, for you to come back. Why would that bookbinder interest me? After all, I had to offer death something.
Dustfinger blew gently into the flame burning on his hand. Oh, I understand you very well, he said quietly, while the fire formed the shape of a bird, a golden bird with a red breast. I understand a good deal now that I've been on the other side, and I know two things for sure. Death obeys no words, and Silvertongue, not you, went to the white women.
He was the only one who could call them. What was I supposed to do? Cried Orpheus, and he did it for his wife, not for you.
Well, now, I'd call that a good reason. The fiery bird fell apart in Dustfinger's hand. And as for the words, to be honest, I like his voice so much better than yours, even if the sound of it didn't always make me happy. Silvertongue's voice is full of love. Yours speaks only of yourself, quite apart from the fact that you're much too fond of reading words no one knows about, or forgetting a few you promised to read. Isn't that so, Farid? Farid just stared at Orpheus, his face rigid with hate. Be that as it may, Dustfinger went on, as the flame in his hand licked out of the ashes again, forming the shape of a tiny skull. I'll take the words with me, and the book.
The book!
Orpheus stepped back, as if the fire on Dustfinger's hand had turned into a snake. Yes, Inkheart. You stole it from Farid, remember? That hardly makes it yours, even if you seem to be busily making use of it from all I hear. Rainbow-colored fairies, spotted brownies, unicorns. They say there are even dwarves in the castle now. What's the idea of all that? Weren't the blue fairies beautiful enough for you? The milksop kicks the dwarves, and you bring unicorns here only to die. No, no, Orpheus raised his hands defensively. You don't understand. I have great plans for this story. I'm still working on them, but believe me, it will be wonderful. Fenolio left so much unsaid. There was so much he didn't describe. I'm going to change it all. I'm going to improve it. Dustfinger turned his hand over and dropped the ashes on the floor of Orpheus's cellar. You sound like Fenolio himself, but I'd guess you're much worse than he is. This world is spinning its own threads. The two of you only confuse them, take them apart, and put them together again in ways that don't really fit, instead of leaving it to the people who live in the place to improve it.
Like who, for instance?
Orpheus's voice turned vicious. The Blue Jay? Since when has he belonged here? Dustfinger shrugged his shoulders. Who knows? Perhaps all of us belong in more than one story. Now bring me the book, or shall I ask Farid to go and get it? Orpheus was staring at him as bitterly as a rejected lover.
No, he got out at last. I need it. The book stays here. You can't take it away from me. I'm warning you. Fenolio's not the only one who can write words to harm you. I can.
I'm not afraid of words anymore. Dustfinger interrupted impatiently. Neither yours nor Fenolio's, and neither of you was able to dictate how I'd die. Have you forgotten that? He reached into the air, and a burning torch grew from his hand. Bring me the book, he said, giving it to Farid. Bring everything he's written, every word. Farid nodded. He was back. Dustfinger was back.
You must take the list, too.
Jasper's voice was as slight as his limbs.
The list he made me draw up. Of all the words Fenolio used, I'm as far as the letter F.
Ah, not a bad idea. A list. Thank you, Glassman. Dustfinger smiled. No, his smile hadn't changed. Farid was so glad he hadn't left that behind with the white women. He put Jasper on his shoulder and went to the stairs. Jink ran after him. Orpheus tried to bar his way, but he flinched back when the torch left his glasses clouded and its flame singed his silk shirt. Oz was braver than his master, but in response to a whisper from Dustfinger, the torch reached out to him with fiery hands, and before Oz had recovered from his fright, Farid was past him. Agile as a gazelle, he leaped up the stairs, his heart full of happiness and the taste of sweet revenge on his tongue.
Jasper, Orpheus called after him, I'm going to smash you into such tiny splinters that no one will even be able to see what color you were.
The glass man dug his fingers into Farid's shoulder, but he didn't turn around.
As for you, you lying little camel driver, Orpheus's voice broke, I'll make you disappear into a story full of horrible things specially written for you.
The threat halted Farid for a moment, but then he heard Dustfinger's voice.
Take care with your threats, Orpheus. If anything ever happens to the boy, or if he suddenly disappears, the fate you clearly intended for him this time, then I'll come to visit you again. And as you know, I never go anywhere without fire.
It was for you, Farid heard Orpheus shouting. I did it all for you. Is this the thanks I get?
Ironstone hurled furious abuse at Farid and his younger brother as soon as he realized what they were looking for in his master's study. But Jasper, unmoved, helped Farid to find first the book and then every scrap of paper that Orpheus had ever written on. Ironstone threw sand and sharp pens at them. He wished every imaginable disease that can afflict a glass man on Jasper, and finally flung himself heroically on the last sheet of paper that Jasper was rolling up on Orpheus's desk. But Farid merely pushed him roughly aside.
Traitor!
Shrieked Ironstone at his brother as Farid closed the door of the study behind him.
I hope you're smashed into 1,000 pieces.
But Jasper did not turn back, any more than he had at the threats made by Orpheus. Dustfinger was already waiting at the front door of the house.
Where are they?
Asked Farid anxiously as he hurried toward him. There was no sign of Orpheus or Os, but he could hear their angry voices.
In the cellar, said Dustfinger. I lost a little fire on the stairs. We'll be well into the forest before it goes out.
Farid nodded, and turned as one of the maids appeared at the top of the stairs, but it wasn't Brianna.
My daughter left, said Dustfinger, as if he had read Farid's thoughts, and I doubt if she'll be coming back to this house.
She hates me, Farid stammered. Why did she help me?
Dustfinger opened the door, and the Martins scurried out.
Perhaps she likes Orpheus even less than you, he said.
Chapter 30. Sootbird's Fire. Fenolio was happy. He was happy, even though Ivo and Despina had taken it into their heads to drag him off to the marketplace, where Sootbird was giving yet another show. The criers had been announcing it for days, and naturally Minerva wasn't letting the children go alone. The milksop had had a platform specially made so that everyone could watch his court fire-eater's incompetent performance. Did they hope such things would make the people forget that the fire dancer was back? Never mind, not even Sootbird could cast a shadow over Fenolio's cheerful mood. His heart hadn't been so light since he had set off with Cosimo for the Castle of Night. And he wasn't going to think of what had happened after that. No, that chapter was closed. His story had struck up a new song. And whose doing was that? His own. Who else had brought the blue jay into the story? The man who had run rings around the piper and the milksop and brought the fire dancer back from the dead. What a character! Orpheus's creations were grotesque by comparison. Garishly colored fairies, dead unicorns, dwarves with a blue tinge to their hair. Yes, that calf's head could bring such creatures into being, but only he, Fenolio, could think up men like the Black Prince and the Blue Jay. Well, he had to admit that only Mortimer had made the Blue Jay flesh and blood. But the words had come first all the same. And it was he who had written them, every single one.
Ivo! Despina!
Where were they, damn it? It was easier to catch Orpheus's rainbow-colored fairies than those children. Hadn't he told them not to run too far ahead? Children were swarming all over the street, coming out of all the houses to forget, at least for an hour or so, the burdens the world had laid on their frail shoulders. It was no fun being a child in these dark times. The boys had become men too young, and the girls found their mother's sadness hard to bear. At first, Minerva hadn't wanted to let Ivo and Despina go. There were too many soldiers in town, and too much work waiting at home, But Fenolio had won her over, although he didn't like the thought of the stink that Sootbird would be spreading again. On a day when he was so happy, however, he wanted the children to be happy too, and while Sootbird put on his pathetic show, he would simply dream of Dustfinger breathing fire in Umbra's marketplace in the near future. Or he would imagine the Blue Jay riding into Umbra and chasing the milksop out of the gates like a mangy dog, knocking the silver nose off the piper's face, and then, together with the Black Prince, founding a realm of justice, ruled by the people. Or perhaps not entirely. This world hadn't reached that point yet. But never mind. It would be wonderful. It would move all hearts. And he, Fenolio, had set the story on the course that would save it when he had written the first song about the Blue Jay. In the end, he'd done everything right. Well, perhaps Cosimo had been a mistake. But where would the excitement be in a story if it wasn't dark from time to time?
Inkweaver, where are you?
Ivo was waving to him impatiently. Did the boy think an old man could just wriggle like an eel through this tide of children's bodies? Despina turned and smiled in relief when Fenolio waved to her. But then her little head disappeared among all the others again.
Ivo, called Fenolio. Ivo, keep an eye on your sister, can't you?
Good heavens, he'd never known how many children there were in Umbra. Many of them were dragging their smaller brothers and sisters along after them as they flocked to the marketplace. Fenolio was the only grown man to be seen, and few of the mothers had come. No doubt most of the children had stolen away on the sly, from workshops and stores, from housework or the stables. They had even come from the surrounding farms in their poor, shabby clothes. Their clear voices were like the twittering of a flock of birds among the buildings. It was unlikely that Sootbird had ever had such an excited audience before. He was already standing on the platform in the black and red costume worn by Fire Eaters, but his clothes weren't patched together from rags like those of his brothers in the trade. They were made of the finest velvet, as befitted a prince's favorite. His ever-smiling face gleamed with the grease he used to protect it from the flames, but by now the fire had licked it so often that it looked like the masks Batista made from leather. Sootbird was smiling again now as he looked down on the sea of little faces, crowding around the platform as eagerly as if he could release them from all their troubles, from hunger, from their mother's sadness, and from missing their dead fathers. Fenolio saw Ivo at the very front. But where was Despina? Ah, over there, right beside her big brother. She waved excitedly to him, and he waved back as he joined the mothers waiting outside the houses. He heard them whispering about the Blue Jay, and how he'd protect their children now that he had brought the Fire Dancer back from the dead. Yes, the sun was shining on Umbra again. Hope was back, and he, Fenolio, had given it a name, the Blue Jay. Sootbird took off his cloak, which was so heavy and expensive that the price of it could surely have fed all the children crowded there in the marketplace for months. A brownie climbed up to him on the platform, hung about with bags full of the alchemist's powders that the inept fire-eater fed to the flames to make them obey him. Sootbird still feared the fire. You could see that clearly. Perhaps he feared it now more than ever, and Fenolio felt uncomfortable watching him begin his show. Flames sprayed and hissed, breathing out poison green smoke that made the children cough. The fire formed shapes, menacing fists, claws, snapping mouths. Sootbird had been learning. He no longer waved a couple of torches around and breathed flames so poorly that everyone whispered Dustfinger's name. The fire he was playing with, though, seemed to be quite different. It was fire's dark brother, a nightmare made of flames. But the children watched the bright, evil spectacle, both fascinated and frightened. They jumped when the fire reached red claws out to them, and groaned in relief when it turned to nothing but smoke. Although the smoke still hung in the air, acrid and making their eyes water. Was what people whispered true? Was it a fact that this smoke befuddled your senses so that you saw more than was really there?
Well, if so, it doesn't work for me, thought Fenolio, as he rubbed his smarting eyes. A set of wretched conjuring tricks, that's all I see.
tears were running down his nose, and when he turned to wipe the soot and smoke out of his eyes, he saw a boy come stumbling down the road from the castle. The lad was older than the children in the square, old enough to be one of Violante's beardless soldiers, but he wore no uniform. His face seemed strangely familiar to Fenoglio. Where had he seen him before?
"Luke!" the boy shouted. "Luke! Run! All of you, run!"
He stumbled, fell, and crawled into a doorway just in time before the man pursuing him on horseback could ride him down. It was the piper. He reined in his horse, while behind him a dozen men-at-arms surged along the road down from the castle. More of them came from every direction. Smith's Alley, Butcher's Alley. They were coming out of every street and alley that led to the marketplace, riding in almost leisurely fashion on their great horses, armoured like their masters. But the children kept staring up at Sootbird, suspecting nothing. They hadn't heard the boys' cries of warning. They didn't see the soldiers. They just stared at the fire while their mothers called their names. By the time the first of them turned, it was too late. The men-at-arms drove back the weeping women, while more and more soldiers surged out of every street, enclosing the children in a ring of iron. Horrified, the little ones spun around. Amazement suddenly turned to pure fear. And the way they cried. How was Fenoglio ever to forget that crying? He stood there, helplessly, his back to a wall, while five men-at-arms kept their lances pointed at him and the women. No more were needed. Five lances to keep the little group in check. One of the women ran for it all the same, but a soldier rode her down. Then they formed a circle of swords at Sootbird at a nod from the piper, extinguished his flames, and bowed to the weeping children with a smile. They drove them up to the castle like a flock of lambs. Some of the little ones were so frightened that they ran here and there among the horses and were left lying on the paving of the road like broken toys. Fenoglio called the names of Ivo and Despina, but his voice merged with all the others, with all the screaming and sobbing. When the men-at-arms let the mothers go, he too stumbled over to the children who had been left behind, bleeding. He stared at the pale faces, terrified of recognizing Despina or Ivo. They weren't there, but Fenoglio felt as though he knew the faces all the same, such small faces. Too young to die, too young for pain and terror. Two white women appeared, his angels of death, and the mothers bent over the children and closed their ears to that white whispering. Three were dead, two boys and a girl. They no longer needed the white women to make the crossing to the other side. The lad who had stumbled along the street, shouting his warning in vain, was kneeling beside one of the dead boys. He stared up at the platform, his young face old with hatred. But Sootbird was gone, as if he had dissolved into the venomous smoke that hung in dense swathes over the marketplace. Only the brownie still stood there looking down, dazed at the women bending over the children. Then, as slowly as if he had fallen out of ordinary time, he began collecting the empty bags left behind by Sootbird. A few of the women had run after the soldiers and the children they were taking away. The rest kneeled there, wiped blood from the foreheads of the injured, and felt their small limbs. Fenoglio couldn't bear it anymore. He turned and walked back, unsteadily, to the street where Minerva's house stood. Women came the other way, brought out of their houses by the screaming. They ran past him. It was too much, too much. Minerva herself came running toward him. He stammered a few broken words, pointed to the castle. She ran after the other women. It was such a fine day. The sun was as warm as if winter were still a long way off. How was he ever going to forget that weeping? Fenoglio was amazed that his legs could still carry his tear-drenched heart up the stairs.
"Rosenquartz!" He supported himself on his table, looked for parchment, paper, anything he could write on. "Rosenquartz! Damn it all! Where are you?"
The glass man peered out of the nest where Orpheus's rainbow-colored fairies lived.
What the devil was he doing up there, wringing their silly necks?
"If you were thinking of sending me off to spy on Orpheus again, forget it,"
Rosenquartz called down to him.
That ironstone has gone and pushed the glass man Orpheus got to replace his brother out of the window. He's so badly smashed, he looks like the remains of a wine bottle.
I don't need you to go spying, snapped Fenolio, in a voice muffled by tears. Sharpen me some pens. Get stirring that ink, and jump to it. Ah, this weeping.
He sank down on his chair and buried his face in his hands. Tears ran through his fingers and dripped onto the table. Fenolio couldn't remember ever having cried so much. Even Cosimo's death had left him dry-eyed.
Evil. Despina.
He heard the glass man landing on his bed. Hadn't he told him not to jump out of the fairy nests? Never mind. Let him break his glass neck if he liked. So much misfortune. There must be an end to it, or his old heart really would break. He heard Rosenquartz hastily clambering up the table leg.
Here you are, said the glass man in a muted voice, offering him a freshly sharpened quill.
Fenolio wiped the tears away from his face with his sleeve. His fingers were shaking as he took the pen. The glass man pushed a piece of paper over to him and quickly set about stirring the ink.
Where are the children? He asked. Weren't you going to the marketplace with them?
Another tear. It fell on the blank sheet, and the paper greedily soaked it up. Just like this wretched story, thought Fenolio, feeding on tears. Suppose Orpheus had written what happened in the marketplace. Folk said he had hardly left his house since the day of Dustfinger's visit to him, and he kept throwing bottles out of the window. In his rage, could he have written words to kill a few children?
Stop it, Fenolio. Don't go thinking about Orpheus. Write something yourself.
He wished the paper wasn't so blank. Come on, he whispered. Come here, words, will you?
The children, children, save them.
Fenolio? Rosenquartz was looking at him with concern.
Where are Ivo and Despina? What's happened?
But all Fenolio could do was bury his face in his hands again.
Where were the words to open those accursed castle gates, break the lances, roast Sootbird in his own fire?
It was Minerva who told Rosenquartz what had happened, when she came back from the castle without her children. The piper had made another speech.
He says he's tired of waiting,
Minerva told him in a toneless voice.
He's giving us a week to bring him the blue jay, or he'll take our children away to the mines.
Then she went down to her empty kitchen, where no doubt the bowls from which Ivo and Despina had eaten that morning still stood, and Fenolio sat there in front of the blank sheet of paper, which showed nothing but the traces of his tears, hour after hour, until late into the night.
Chapter 31. The Blue Jay's Answer. Risa, her face pale, was writing in her best script. Just as she had long ago when she used to sit in men's clothes in Ombra Marketplace, earning her living as a scribe. Orpheus's former glassman was stirring the ink for her. Dustfinger had brought Jasper back to the robber's cave with him. And Farid, too. This is the Blue Jay's answer, wrote Risa, with Mo standing beside her. In 3 days' time, he will give himself up to Violante, widow of Cosimo, and mother of the rightful heir of Ombra. In exchange, the piper will set free the children of Ombra whom he tricked into his power. This agreement shall be sealed with his master's seal, so that they may be safe for all time. Only when this condition is met will the Blue Jay be prepared to cure the white book that he bound for the Adderhead in the Castle of Night. Meggie saw her mother's hand falter again and again as she wrote. The robbers stood around, watching her. A woman who could write. Apart from Batista, none of them had that skill, not even the Black Prince. They had all tried to keep Mo from giving himself up, even Doria, who had done his best to warn the children of Ombra, and then had to watch as the piper caught them and his best friend Luke was killed. In vain. Only one person hadn't even attempted to make Mo change his mind. Dustfinger. It seemed almost as if he'd never been away, even though his face now had no scars. The same smile, enigmatic as ever, the same swift movements,
He was here one moment, gone the next. Like a ghost. Meggie found herself thinking so again and again. Yet at the same time, she sensed that Dustfinger was more alive than ever before. More alive than anyone. Mo looked her way, but Meggie wasn't sure that he really saw her. Ever since he had come back from the White Women, he seemed to be more the Blue Jay than ever. How could he give himself up as a prisoner? The Piper would kill him. Risa had finished writing the letter. She looked at Mo as if hoping just for a moment that he would throw the parchment on the fire. But he only took the pen from her hand and added his sign under the deadly words. A pen and a sword forming a cross. In the way peasants made their mark instead of signing their names because they didn't understand letters.
No. No.
Risa bowed her head. Why didn't she say anything? Why couldn't she shed some tears to make him change his mind this time? Had she used them all up on that endless night among the graves, when they stood waiting in vain for him to come back? Did Risa know what Mo had promised the White Women in return for letting him and Dustfinger go again? I may soon have to go away, was all he had told Meggie. And when she had asked, full of fear,
Go away? Where to?
All he had said was, Don't look at me so anxiously. Wherever I go, I visited death and come back safe and sound. It can hardly be more dangerous than that, can it? She ought to have asked more questions, but Meggie had felt too glad, indescribably glad, that she hadn't lost him forever.
You're out of your mind. I've said so before, and I'll say it again.
Snapper was drunk. He stood there red in the face, his brusque voice breaking the oppressive silence so suddenly that the glass man dropped the pen Mo had handed him.
Giving yourself up to the adder's spawn in the hope that she can protect you from the Piper? He'll soon teach you better. And even if Silvernose leaves you alive, do you still think his master's daughter will help you to write in that damn book? You must have left your reason behind with death. Her ugliness will sell you for the throne of Umbra, and the Piper will send the children to the mines all the same.
Many of the robbers murmured agreement, but they fell silent when the Black Prince went to Mo's side. How are you going to get the children out of the castle then, Snapper? He asked evenly. I don't like to think of the Blue Jay riding through the castle gates of Umbra either. But if he doesn't give himself up, then what? I couldn't answer him when he asked that question, and believe me, I've been thinking of nothing else since Sootbird's performance. Are we to attack the castle with the few men we have? Will you lie in ambush when they take the children through the Wayless Wood? How many men-at-arms will be guarding them? 50? 100? How many dead children do you expect to see if you try freeing them that way? The Black Prince scrutinized the ragged men standing around him. Many of them lowered their heads, but Snapper defiantly thrust out his chin. The scar on his neck was as red as a fresh cut. I'll ask you once again, Snapper, said the Black Prince quietly. How many children would die if we tried rescuing them like that? Would we manage to save even one? Snapper didn't reply. He just stared at Mo. Then he spat, turned, and marched away, followed by Gecko and a dozen others. But Risa took the written sheet of parchment without a word and folded it so that Jasper could seal it. Her face was as expressionless as if it were made of stone, like the face of Cosimo the Fair in the vault in Umbra Castle. But her hands were trembling so much that finally Batista went over and folded the parchment for her. 3 days, once again. Mo had been gone with the White Women for that long as well. 3 endless days that had made Meggie believe her father was dead beyond recall this time. And it was her mother's fault. And Fareed's, too. She hadn't exchanged a single word with either of them during those 3 days. And when Risa approached her, she had pushed her away. Meggie, why are you looking at your mother like that? Mo had asked her on the first day after his return.
Why? The White Women took you away because of her,
she wanted to say, and then didn't. She knew she was being unfair, but the coolness between her and Risa was still there. She couldn't forgive Fareed either. He was standing beside Dustfinger and was the only one who didn't look depressed. Of course, why would Fareed care that her father was about to hand himself over to the Piper?
Dustfinger was back. Nothing else counted. He had tried to make up their quarrel.
Come on, Meggie. No harm can